Okay, Matthew 23, verses 33 through 36. We're still in the last week of Jesus' life. This information, of course, anticipates what we have in Matthew 24, the first part of that chapter describing the destruction of Jerusalem. You may remember that Jesus has come down pretty hard on the Pharisees and the scribes. He's called them hypocrites back there in verses 29 and 30. He said that they built sepulchers for the prophets. They garnished the tombs of the righteous. They made it sound like they were very interested in God's servants in the past, but Jesus said, you've killed them. You did not have an interest in really supporting, listening to the servants of God, and now you are about ready to kill me. So in verse 33, he says, ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how shall ye escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them shall ye kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues, and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of Abel the righteous unto the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation." We ended our class last time in talking about the national guilt of the Jews. We said the people do not inherit sin. Ezekiel 18:20 says, the soul that sins, it shall die. We do not inherit sin, but we can suffer the consequences of sin. And in cases where nations become guilty of bad behavior, a time can come when God says, you filled up your cup. In other words, things have just kind of been going along and it's been getting worse and worse and worse. We have similar expressions. Finally, we say, we finally fell off where? The cliff. We got far enough to the edge, and this is really what Jesus is saying about these folks. Now, if you look carefully, Jesus appeals to two Old Testament characters. The first being who? He goes back to the blood of Abel and the blood of Zechariah. Do you think that Zechariah is the father of John the Baptist? No. So it's a case where we have the same name but different characters. So eliminate any connection with John the Baptist. Anybody know where this Zechariah is mentioned? Second Chronicles chapter 24, verse 20. Anybody know anything beyond that? Why would Jesus have cited a character from Genesis, Abel, and then cited a character from the book of Second Chronicles? Seems kind of odd.
And sorry, chronologically, the beginning and end?
Yeah. Today we say from A to Z. From Genesis to Revelation. And we try to say, okay, this is the full span. This is everything. If the Hebrew people were going to do this, they would say from Genesis to 2 Chronicles. Now, we don't see the Old Testament in that way. We would start with the book of Genesis and we'd end at where? Malachi. But for the Jews, their Old Testament ended with the book of 2 Chronicles. So when Jesus takes these two characters, it is really A to Z. The beginning of the Old Testament to the end of the Old Testament. And you can see why he does that. He wants to say, if there is this pattern of you showing hatred and persecution for God's people, begins here in the Old Testament with Abel, runs all the way through what you would regard to be the last book of the Old Testament, 2 Chronicles. Now, if you've studied this out, if you go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 20, you will find that the word son doesn't line up with what we have here in Matthew chapter 23. There are a couple of reasons for that. When we think of the word son, we look at that word in a very restrictive way. For example, if I say I'm your son, well, we would expect a certain biological relationship. But when you look at the word son in the Bible, it is a fairly broad word. Son could describe a son in the biological sense. It could describe a grandparent, which for us, that's kind of hard to imagine. But son could describe a lot of different things. Two, you have sometimes situations where people had two names. Remember the New Testament character, Matthew? He also was named
Levi.
So if you call him Matthew, well, he'll respond to that. But if you refer to him as Levi, he could respond to that. So if you go back and you look at 2 Chronicles 24:20, the information here in Matthew chapter 23, and you see a difference in the names, and you say, you know, the son of is not the same guy. Son of Jehoiada and the son of Berechiah, you know, how does that square up? Well, I've just given two possible explanations. We don't know which one may be correct. But it's definitely not a contradiction. It's helpful to know because sometimes, and this is especially true, I think, for a lot of our young people, they will read through the Bible, they'll see this information and say, well, hey, the names don't match up. Son of Berechiah, son of Jehoiada, Bible contradiction. Well, no, wait a minute. They don't match, but is there a reason they don't match? And we can offer, like I say, at least two explanations, two Bible explanations for why that may be the case. One other quick point, the word righteous in verse 35 is used twice, and it reminds us, and we'll see this a little later, probably as we get into Luke 21, the story of the widow with the two mites. We know who is righteous. God knows who's righteous and who is not. And it's also a term that tells us that the best thing that we can do for our community and our nation is to be a righteous individual. Righteousness, remember what the Old Testament says, righteousness does what for a nation? Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. So a lack of righteousness in a nation is a very, very bad thing and can ultimately destroy it. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with Matthew 23, verse 37?
Seems like the way this nation is going, I tell you, especially after Obama changed his mind about gay marriage.
Yeah. Anytime you have a leader, whether it is a local leader or whether it is a national leader, and they make a decision or they offer information about morality, positive or negative, it's going to have an impact on people. And that's certainly going to be true for those when we think about the federal level. It could be a judge. We've got some judges that have decided some good things and some bad things. Our senators, Congress, and certainly the president is going to have a huge, huge impact. But it's true. The leaders in a nation are going to have a huge impact. But we also have a role to make sure that we're trying to be the best light that we can. So, Julie?
This might not apply now. You sort of moved on past it. But when you were talking about the Jewish law between Genesis and Second Chronicles, now, I guess my question is, I was under the impression, the few Jewish people I knew, that they just believed in the first five books. So is that true, or do they believe in the whole Old Testament?
There were some, for example, if you think about the Samaritans, if we could go back to the first century, the Samaritans would have accepted the first five books of the Old Testament, but not the rest. And when you think about the Sadducees, they too would have accepted the first five books of the Old Testament, but not the rest. Pharisees, okay, you know, we're on board with the rest of the Old Testament. So depending on which group of Jews, or in the case of the Samaritans, they were sort of half Jew and, you know, half not. But depending on the group that you had, there certainly were some. And today you probably find that same kind of thing. We know, as we think about the New Testament, there are some that will not accept the writings of Paul. There are some people that there are some people, they don't come across my radar screen too often, but there are some people who would say, unless it's written in red, which God didn't put the red, you know, letters in there, but unless it's written in red, it really doesn't count. It's got to be, you know, spoken by Jesus and in red. So people throughout time have had some very interesting ideas as far as whether or not the 66 books are truly from God or not.
Do they have like a classification of that, or, you know, like a name for it? If you're Jewish, you know,
if there is, it's probably going to be somewhat limited, and, you know, it would be within that particular group where they would designate it. It would almost, if you can take a leading denomination today, somebody says, I'm a Baptist. That can mean 12 different things to 12 different people who profess to be of the Baptist faith. And you find that same kind of thing today. Same thing is true for a Christian. A person says, I'm a Christian. Well, what does that mean exactly? We kind of have to get in there and, you know, sort and sift and see exactly what that means. Glenda, you had a thought?
I was just going to say, to see the Dead Sea Scrolls in Chicago. And there was a time after a certain time of day when the Jewish people came in, and those people were wailing and crying and throwing themselves on the, you know, so when you just said the Samaritans, it was kind of like...
Yeah. Well, and I think, without talking to them, I guess, or getting a little information you probably wouldn't know for sure, but my suspicion would be that they were not weeping for grief, but it was a great honor, a great joy. Just as people today, we've been so privileged, and they break into tears of joy because for the Jews. When you go back, I didn't use this information, but I came across this a few days ago. We probably should go back and figure out where it came from and use it, but when you go back and you look at the Jews, there were actually some cases where they bought seats to be in a position where they could actually hold the scrolls of God. They considered, I mean, we don't consider that to be a big deal today. Somebody says, well, you're the scripture reader for the day. Oh, man, me again? That's kind of how people respond sometimes. But for the Jews to hold a copy of God's word, this was a magnificent, this was a holy, this was a special thing, and people would pay money for it. You go back and you look at this country. There were even times where people paid money to sit in the best pews. They'd pay money to sit up front. Now you just about have to get a cattle whip to get folks to sit up front. But you go back 100 years, and this was a high honor. People were thinking, well, hey, you've got to be rich to get the best seat in the house. All right, Matthew 23, verse 37. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets, and stoneth them that are sent unto her. How often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. This is based on what Jesus has said. Remember the Jewish nation? He said, God sent prophets to you, and what have you done? Rejected them, killed them, stoned them. And you're going to continue to reject the messengers, in this case, the Christian messengers. The Jews were the people who professed to be God's people, were the chosen ones. But John chapter 1, verse 11 says, the Lord came into his own, and they did not receive him. They rejected him. And as we think about where we are in Matthew 23, a few days from this time, what's going to happen? Jesus is going to be crucified. The Romans are going to do it, but that's going to be because the Jews are really encouraging that kind of thing. So now Jesus, just a few days before his crucifixion, he refers to the city of Jerusalem. And this city did a good job as far as representing the Jewish people as a whole. It was the place where a lot of God's people had been dealt with in an unjust way, and now the city was going to suffer and suffer greatly because of how they had treated God's prophets. The tenses that Jesus uses are very, very interesting. Jesus said that God had sent prophets. Now here's a case where you might think it's the present tense, but that's sort of true, but it's amplified a little bit. He uses the perfect tense. In other words, remember we said with the perfect tense, it would be like Jesus was crucified. That was something that happened in the past, but the benefits continue. So in this particular case, you've got God's prophets. It's almost like there's been this steady stream of prophets. Now the stream has kind of reached its head. Who's on deck? Jesus is. So God has been very good, very gracious. The people have killed off several of these people, but God has continued to send. And yet, as God continued to send his people, Jesus says they've been stoned. What would you think about the tense there? Present tense. Ongoing action. Then he says the prophets were also killed, and once again he uses the present tense. Can you imagine how God must have felt? I think most of us, if we were God and we had sent people to help this nation, and we sent them and sent them and sent them and sent them, it's almost like sending money and people, especially people, to a foreign nation. And the foreign nation responds by killing our sons and daughters. Well, after about the second death, what would we be thinking? We're going to cut you off. We've had enough. If that's going to be how you treat our people, and then we decide to send our mate, or we decide to send the person that's closest to us, and they say, we're not only going to kill your mate, we're going to kill that person in the most gruesome way possible. Do you think you'd be pretty frustrated? I think most people would be outraged. Well, this is really what happened with God and the Jewish people. He continued to send. The Lord continues to try to help the people, but finally they turn on him and destroy him. Now, compare what I just described with one of the common ideas about God. Do we live in a culture where a lot of people think that God is a judgmental God? If he would send people to hell, he's a cruel God? Yes. I got some heads wagging yes and some heads wagging no.
They think that he's just going to accept anything and everything.
Right. There are a lot of people who have that particular idea, and they struggle with the idea. And then when they say, well, hey, if that's true, if your version of God is right, that he actually is a God who's going to destroy people, and based on what we find in passages like Matthew 7, if he's going to destroy most people, is he really then a loving God? No, he's not, if this is going to be the way he behaves. But what do we see as far as a picture about God in Matthew 23? Has he been patient? He sent and sent and sent. And people have responded to his servants in the worst possible ways. And yet God continues to stand ready to forgive people. The end of the verse compares the Jewish people to what? What animal? Chickens. Now chickens are interesting for a couple of reasons. God is pictured as a hen that would be ready to gather the chickens beneath its wings. Really an Old Testament imagery. You see it in Deuteronomy chapter 32 about verse 11. Also in Ruth chapter 2 verse 12. But the Jewish people were not willing to respond. A few of us have probably had some exposure to chickens. If you've ever been involved with chickens, you've got one chicken running across the barnyard, what are the other chickens that see it going to do? They're going to follow it. Do they need to know where that one is going? Nope. They're just going to follow it.
It's just like we see a lot of people running. We really don't ask questions. We just say, I'm running.
You're exactly right. This is also really seen vividly in the area of religion, is it not? You've got folks that are headed off in this direction, and people don't think it through. They just, well, hey, if the majority or somebody that I respect is headed in that way, let's be in that same group. Let's go ahead and follow. Jesus says the Jewish people responded in this particular way. Safety was available, but the people were not willing to embrace it. Now, there was, that's going back, you know, several years, about 20 years, to 25 years, back in 1988, a fire in Yellowstone. And it was kind of a scorched earth fire, did a lot of damage, and after the fire had been put out, there was a ranger that decided he would be among the folks that went in and began to assess the damage. So he's checking things out, and as he's, you know, looking at things, he finds that there is this petrified bird. He gets a stick, turns over the petrified bird, and you want to guess what runs out? Three baby chicks. Mom was willing to stay there and die for those chicks. I think that's a good image when we think about Matthew chapter 23. God says, hey, I'm willing to do whatever I can to offer you protection, even to the point of sending my son. I will give, just as that bird gave its life for those three chicks. God says, I'm going to give the life of deity. I'm going to give the life of my son to protect you, to spread his wings over you. But, you know, you simply would not respond. Now, if you're going to behave in that way, then God finally has to throw up his hands and say what?
I'm done.
That's it. I'm done. There is only one choice. And now you're going to have to pay for your sin, for your rejection. This is where Jesus heads to in verses 38 and 39. Anything that you want to add or ask before we come to these final two verses? Okay. Yeah. You know, when we look at various nations throughout time, God has said, you kind of go back to the cup of iniquity. God says, okay, you're filling up the cup. And hey, it's time to start emptying out some of the water and head back to the area of righteousness instead of evil. But people just, well, hey, God's gracious and he's kind, and it just builds and builds and builds, and it's just like a balloon. After a while, it's so full, no more can be put in. And there is, if you will, an explosion. All right, verses 38 and 39. 38 says, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. The word house is a little uncertain. It could refer to the temple. The word house might also refer to the city of Jerusalem. There's really no way in my mind to identify one over the other. But we do know that Jesus says this house is being. He uses a present tense verb. This is in the process of being destroyed. Well, that was also true of the temple. It was true of the city, so maybe we're probably not going to be too far off if we include both things, the temple as well as the city, when we think about the desolation. The word desolation is not used in all manuscripts. If you don't have that particular word or a similar word in your Bible, that would account for that. But if it was intended, it would be either abandoned to the enemy or deserted by God. God was going to do both of those things when the Romans came against Jerusalem about 40 years later in 70 AD. The temple was ransacked, the city of Jerusalem was ravaged, and it was really, really bad. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting, if you will compare with what we just read, Matthew chapter 21, verse 13, you'll see a subtle but I think important difference. Matthew 21, 13, and he saith unto them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but ye make a den of robbers. What's the difference between Matthew 21:13 and what we have here in the final verses of Matthew 23?
Your house.
Yeah, my house, Matthew 21. Now Jesus says it's your house because he knew what these people were going to do in really just a matter of hours. And when you crucify the Son of God, that's about as bad as it gets. When we think about war, a lot of times Germany is probably a good example of this. Bombs and other things pretty much rip it apart. But with time, people can rebuild. and maybe even the new building that results is going to be better than before. But what about Jerusalem? The city is still there, but what about the temple? Ever been rebuilt? No. More than 2,000 years ago, it was destroyed, and about 2,000 years ago, and it's not going to be rebuilt. One of the important military officers that was involved with the destruction of Jerusalem was a fellow by the name of Titus. If you go back and you look at history, Titus is reputed to have made a very, very interesting statement. It said that he refused the victory wreath because, this is a quote, "There is no merit in vanquishing a people forsaken by their God." Now imagine that coming from the mouth of a heathen. He has this victory and he looks at it. He says, these people have been forsaken by their God. That's pretty bad. But this statement dovetails very nicely with what Jesus describes here in Matthew 23 as well as Matthew 24. Verse 39 is a difficult text. And I think my explanation of it is going to be a good bit different than what you might immediately suspect. Looking at it once more. "For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." Generally, I think when people look at this passage, they think, well, hey, Jesus is going to come again. Well, that's true. If this were the way to approach the verse, you'd probably have to come out with one of two conclusions. It could be that he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, anticipating the discussion in Matthew chapter 24. Or it could mean that he is referring to his end of time coming. He did come in both senses. My thinking, though, is that we're probably dealing with a different point of emphasis. We do know as we look at verse 39 that this comes from the Old Testament. If you were to turn back to Psalm 118, verse 26, this is the same psalm, Psalm 118, verse 22, that talks about the stone. It was offered, but it was rejected. So it certainly is a messianic psalm. Then, four verses later, Psalm 118, verse 26, the words that we have here by Jesus in Matthew 23, verse 39, are essentially repeated there. So here, I don't think we're talking about necessarily his coming, but he's talking about a relationship with him. Look at it in this way. "For I say unto you, ye shall not see me." Well, think about that in terms of John 3. Jesus said, ye shall not see the kingdom of God. What's he mean? Literally see? No. See in what sense? All right, you're not going to have fellowship. You're not going to have participation in. There's not going to be any kind of joining. Not yet.
Could that be meaning that?
Possibly. Like I say, it's a text that's a little bit vague. The explanation, though, that I like is what I think you can kind of read from the text. You're not going to have any fellowship with me till what? You look at me and say, I am
Christ.
I'm the Christ. I'm the Blessed One. Jesus said, you have zero spiritual hope until you get your spiritual thinking cap on right. Now, that may not be what he means, but that statement is certainly true, is it not? People cannot have a right relationship with God until they really understand who Jesus is. All right, anything that you want to add or ask over what we've said about Matthew 23? Brian?
I think it's interesting. It's the same phrase that she's back in chapter 21 on the entry into Jerusalem. The people at that time were saying, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, who is in the highest. And now Jesus is telling these people, until you get to the point that those people were at,
right, and I think that would further cement this particular interpretation. Now, those folks apparently didn't realize exactly what they were saying, but still, the sentiment that they had was right. And Jesus is trying to, as I said, cement that belief that, hey, you need to go back and get on this particular track. Because until you do, you're going to lose your city. Ultimately, you're going to lose your soul. It ties in well, I think, with some other references. Remember Acts 4:12? And in how many other names do we find salvation? None other. So it's got to be through Christ. No man can come to the Father but by me. So, like I say, it may not be the right explanation, but it certainly lines up very, very well, especially when we look at where we are in Jesus' life. Anything else before we pick up with our next section? Stan?
I don't have anything to back this up with right now, but in verse 38, when he says your house, might that not be a euphemism for their security? Because it comforts the temple, Jerusalem, or their literal physical house. All three of those things would symbolize the security of the people.
Yeah. Yeah, when we think about house, that is the one place where people typically feel safe. So in general terms, yes, everything, well, their physical houses, if they were in Jerusalem, were going to be, you know, lost or looted. The temple was certainly going to be lost, and the national hope that they had because they were God's people. So once again, you can wrap all of those things into that particular word, and it's a way of saying bad news is coming. It's going to take a little while before it's fulfilled, but many in that generation actually witnessed it. All right, the next section is going to involve several things. We're still on the Tuesday before Jesus was crucified on Friday. We're going to read about some Greeks who came to see Jesus. This is the day where Jesus witnessed the widow making her offering at the temple treasury. The Father's going to speak from heaven, but most of the Jews are still not going to believe. We're almost ready for Matthew 24. In fact, I'm going to kind of wait and see how things go. But we've got some information from Luke 21, which is where we turn now. We'll also pull a little bit from the parallel in Mark chapter 12, and a few classes, probably about three or four more, then we'll be ready for Matthew 24. We've tried to take a break from the textual class and go to a book in the fall, so we'll kind of wait and see how things go, but we might get right up to the edge of Matthew 24 and then stop it right there. Then turn to that book for the fall, and once we get through with the book in the spring, pick up with the textual class again and start sorting through Matthew 24 so we have a nice even break. All right, Luke chapter 21, verses 1 through 4. And he looked up and saw the rich men that were casting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a certain poor widow casting in thither two mites. And he said, of a truth, I say unto you, the poor widow cast in more than they all. For all these did of their superfluity cast in unto their gifts, but she of her want did cast in all the living that she had. Now Mark's account of this is also helpful. Mark chapter 12, in verse 35, it says, he sat down over against the treasury and beheld how the multitude cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. Mark 12, 35, and also Mark chapter 12, verse 41. Do you remember what feast was about to occur? Jesus was crucified about the time of the Passover, right? Jesus is our Passover, 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Now, anytime you have a feast or a festival, what happens to a town? All right, people are going to come in from outside the area, and it's always going to be a time we have some extra folks. Would you expect that people, because of the Passover, would have been making their trip to the temple and probably been making more contributions than usual? I think that's probably reasonable. So this was an ideal time for Jesus to kind of sit back and see what was taking place as far as people. There were some rich people. Doesn't say if they were from in town, maybe out of town, but it is clear that, especially from Mark's account, that they came and they gave much. Then Jesus sees this widow. Mark's account, chapter 12, verse 42, says he saw a poor widow making an offering. One source said, from considering the corrupt character of the Pharisees, Jesus must have turned with pleasure to look upon the beautiful heart of this devout widow. And I think that's a good point. We always talk about, you know, bad news or some unfortunate things. We like bright spots, do we not? The silver lining in the cloud. You think God may have a similar view? Looks down at the world and sees all kinds of bad things, but he's able to say, hey, right over there, Goshen, Indiana, there's a bright spot. Middlebury, Indiana, a bright spot. So that kind of takes us back to what we said in Matthew chapter 23. We want to try to live a righteous life. We also see, as we study this lady and the account about giving, that he knows not only how much we give, but he also knows the motive behind our giving. When we look at how the money was given, anybody know anything about what's believed concerning the way that things were set up at the temple area to give? You know, Jesus says they were casting in much. How would you know that? Well, okay. He could have known it because he was deity. If the disciples had been there, do you think they might have been able to tell that there was much being given by some folks? I think that's one possibility. Remember back there, I believe it's Matthew chapter 6, verse 22, Jesus said they sound what before they give? They sound the trumpet, remember? You think anybody was going to sound the trumpet for a dollar bill?
Matthew and Judas were there.
Yeah, I imagine they did. But do you think somebody was going to sound the trumpet for a dollar bill? No. But if somebody put in 200, 500, 1,000, you think they would have been sounding the trumpet? You see it on the telethons today, don't you? What happens? Oh, we got a $10,000 donation. Ring, ring, ring. Woo! You know, the lights and the sirens go off, that kind of thing. Well, that's not new. People were doing it in that day and time. Anything else, though? It's believed that in the temple area, there were 13 vases, if you will. Vases that would have been shaped kind of like a trumpet. If you have gone to maybe a restaurant, we use them now typically for kids. You can put the quarter in the little twirly thing, and you see it goes round and round and round and round, and then kind of makes a splash at the bottom. One quarter is not going to make, you know, very much of an impression. But, you know, you put $20 of quarters in one of those things. You think that's going to get some attention?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So it seems there looks like there's enough evidence to believe that the Jews had 13 different trumpets that were basically collection baskets. And when the people came up, I mean, it was just, wow. You could actually see it or hear, you know, the fact that somebody was giving a great deal of money. So if you wanted to put on a show when it came time to give, it would have been very, very easy to do that. I think a couple of quick points relate to this. I actually had a call from somebody not long ago, a member of the church, asking about the place where they're now worshiping. They said, we're in this particular place, and the way that they take a collection is unlike any way that we've ever been. You know, they will just put the basket up front. They never pass a basket, and if you want to give, you just have to make your way to the basket at some point. The question posed to me was, is that okay? Now, if you'd gotten that call, what would you have said? They never pass a basket. If you're going to give before the service, maybe at some point during the service, after the service, you got to go up there and put your money in.
But we're not told how to give.
All right, that's it. We're told when to give, are we not? 1 Corinthians 16, verse 2, on the first day of the week. So God has legislated that. Now, we, you know, Galatians 6:10 talks about as we have opportunity, so there may be some special circumstances, but the first day of the week is definitely a day. Are we not told also how much to give? Right, according as we've been prospered, so that's the information as far as the amount. We're not under the Old Testament system of tithing. Have we also been told what to give as far as an attitude?
Yes.
Second Corinthians 6, 8 through 10, do not be grudging. So those three basic things are covered. We are not, though, told how to give. Could we pass a hat?
Yes.
Could we pass a basket?
Yes.
A lot of different ways. Could we have an ATM machine? We were talking about this at the last preacher's meeting. Could we have an ATM machine in the lobby?
Swipe a credit card.
Yeah, we could have somebody, potentially you've got some cell phones now that have a little program called Square that can take a credit card. We could potentially have somebody standing out at the edge of the aisle with a credit card machine, and they could just swipe it for folks. Now, I think a lot of folks, especially in the Midwest, would kind of freak out about that, especially if we went to a place and they were saying, well, just pass your credit card down, you know, the aisle. But we are coming to a time where we have to think, you know, about some of these things. And we also need to realize that there are some things that would fall more into the category of tradition than this is how you have to do it. And this is going to be one of these particular areas. So bear this in mind. We might see some, you know, changes. I'm not saying here, but we might see some changes at some point in the place where we worship. And that's not necessarily bad. In this particular call, I also made the point that we've got to do these things decently in order. Remember, Paul talked about that in 1 Corinthians chapter 40. So, you know, having somebody stand down at the end of the aisle with a credit card machine, that might not be the most orderly procedure. But still, always remember that when we've got the basics, we've got the right day, we've got the right spirit, we're giving, as we've been prospered, God has not legislated in the manner that we must give. Anything that you want to add or ask over that particular point? Betsy?
I noticed that witnesses, they have contribution boxes at the back of their hall as they're called. Mm-hmm. And they can give as much as they want.
Right.
They claim they always come up with enough sometimes as a service, but they don't come up lacking.
Right. We could do that here. Right. We could have a box, maybe right out there by one of the exterior doors. And I think a lot of people would say, boy, is that scriptural? Well, yes, it is. Is it the most expedient way to do things? Maybe, maybe not. But there would not, I mean, we're still giving, bearing in mind those three or four basic principles that we talked about. So we want to do it right, but at the same time, we don't want to lock ourselves into something that is not based on thus saith the Lord. Betty?
The only thing that I see with leaving the plate up there it tells us to do it in an orderly fashion.
Right.
Not, you know, a disturbance to the whole congregation. So you either have to give before or you give after, because if you're up giving during the middle, the preacher's up here preaching or you're singing,
right,
and people walk up, and unless you have a certain song that they walk up and, you know, give at that time or something like that. But if you've got a congregation of 300 to 500 people, or even just, you
right,
know, our congregation size, even that could be very disruptive, mm-hmm, if you don't have a certain set time of going up and giving the contribution.
Yeah. And that's true. Now, this particular situation that I described is going to be a congregation that would be less than 50. Substantial less than 50. So in that particular case, it's going to be okay. But you're right. Not everything is going to work in every particular place. And some of it is going to be driven by size. And God was aware of that, so he was able to make things flexible enough so we're not locked into the kind of arrangement that is going to be burdensome for any size group. Brian, and then we'll take your hand, Scott.
I used to report that my dad experienced that in Africa when they were in Nigeria. That was how contributions were taken on Sunday.
And when you,
it took a while.
Right, when you start traveling, whether it's in this country and especially outside this country, some really are in for cultural shock when it comes to that part of worship or some other things. But we need to remember that a lot of the things that we do are, you know, we've got a preacher behind a pulpit. You know, there's nothing in the Bible that says you have a pulpit, but that is an expedient manner to help us carry out the command. Scott.
What can the house be like? You go up and sort of just go up in the middle of something, kind of like, you know, look at me. Isn't that kind of too?
Like sure.
What the rich man did,
yeah,
back then.
I'm reminded of a story. I think it was probably not true, but a little congregation in Kentucky, whole family took up a pew. And everybody that, you know, started on this particular section of the pew, you know, they'd knock the collection plate. Well, they knocked the plate to give the impression that they were giving, but they were actually picking up some cash. And then they passed that to the next person, the family member, and they weren't stealing it, but they passed that to the next person in the pew. So you kind of get down here to, you know, all the cousins and everybody, and then down at the end, you know, this guy's got a fistful of money. So he opens it up, you know, and it looks like he's the biggest giver in the place. So it looked like everybody gave, and then you have the super giver at the end. Well, people have tried different variations of that today, to boast about what they're bragging and doing, and God says, hey, I'm just not interested in that kind of thing. So one of the quick, and people are thinking, well, hey, you know, it's this time during the service, and I'll just hop online and use PayPal or another service to go ahead and pay. Well, you know, maybe you do that, but people being people, do you think that they might, after they finish up with a couple more things, well, let's make a quick Facebook post. Let's make a lunch reservation. Let's check email. So, like I say, there's some technology out there, but not all that technology may be expedient. All right, next item, the lady. She is described as a poor woman. This is an interesting word. It's found only here in the New Testament, and it really has the sense it could be translated penniless. One source asked if this woman contributed her great gift, and this is interesting. He asked if she contributed her great gift after listening to the hours of fiery debate. Was this gift her own personal answer to the grand emphasis she had just heard Jesus place upon loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength? From a preacher's standpoint, I can tell you that, and I'm just thinking in general terms, I'm not thinking about this particular congregation, but a sermon can be preached which would be helpful to some folks, but the folks that probably would have helped the most, what happens to them? They go out and say, great sermon, preacher. She really needed that. And I'm not pointing to anybody in specific, specifically. You know, they missed it. But then you have some other folks that will really listen and say, hey, I can make application of that. And maybe after Jesus got through with this discussion, love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, this woman was thinking, I don't have very much. But the Lord spoke the truth. So my two mites, I'm going to go ahead and do exactly what he said. So the spoken word still can have great, great power. Then there's some other things to consider. Remember back there in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus talked about the scribes and the widows. What did he say? The widows. were treated well or they were abused? They were abused. Lost their houses. I wonder why this woman was penniless. Could it have been that a scribe took what she had? Could be. Now, if that had happened, and that had occurred in our day and time, what would we find sometimes among people as far as an attitude? They shafted me? Am I going to go back? I'm done with them. Can't say for sure. But I think it's very, very interesting that if this woman was cheated by religious people, she still said, I'm going to go to the house of God. And what am I going to do? I'm going to give as much as I possibly can. She was committed to God and sought to serve Him to the best of her ability. So, once again, a lot of details we do not have about her, but very, very interesting. Then you consider this point. We know that the rich were casting in how much? Lots. Could she have looked at her life and said, well, you know, I don't know what they were giving, but let's say here's somebody that has 2 cents, their final 2 cents, and somebody else has $500 they can give. We can look at our 2 cents and say, is it going to matter? Can't count. Can't compare to the guy who's going to give $500. So we need some bread, so we're going to hold on to the 2 cents. It's not going to count. Well, it's probably not going to count very much in the sense that it's going to pay an electric bill or it's going to pay to have the garbage picked up or anything else. But does it count in the ultimate sense? It does. It counts as far as the sight of God, and that's really what matters. Somebody mentioned that Jesus may have known how much this woman gave because he was deity. That's certainly true. And we know that he didn't need to investigate the circumstances to figure out exactly how much she had. We also have some comments about this particular woman that are very, very striking. A couple minutes left. Let's give you a little more information. The word might is translated, or could be translated, thin one. You may have a footnote on that. It describes the smallest Greek coin. It would have been money that was made out of copper. If you look back in Mark chapter 12, verse 42, you find that two of these coins made a farthing, that is, a fourth of a cent. Now, today we have people, oftentimes they say, well, I'm on a fixed income. I'm barely getting by. I don't have much extra. Would any of these statements have been true for this woman? I think that's true. But let me ask my question again. We have people today who say, I'm on a fixed income, I'm barely making it. Would you say that these statements would be equal to the situation of this woman? I mean, you've basically got nothing at this point. Where people today say, I'm getting by, I'm barely making it, they've got a dollar left over at the end of the month, but they've covered everything.
Yeah, they're still paying bills.
They're still paying bills. But in this particular case, when you look at this woman, when we think about someone who's destitute, she's in the destitute. I mean, when you think about poor, she is poverty-stricken. So when she comes and gives this, some think it was her daily income. This was all she got. We do know that people were paid from day to day. Matthew 6, verse 11, and that could be the point here. Anything that you want to add or ask? A couple other things I want to develop, but we're going to hold